Good morning. The position of the employer petitioner in this matter is that, based entirely on the government witness's testimony, there is not evidence to there's not enough evidence to establish that the violations occurred. For example, the alleged no Chevron rule was not maintained. The government called six witnesses, four employees and two foremen, all of them that went out on strike. All four of the employees were credited by the judge. All four of these employees testified that they continued to go to the Chevron every single day.
Does it matter that they didn't obey the directive if the directive was in fact issued?
Well, there's two issues. Go ahead.
Well, there's two issues. One, was there an utterance made on the particular day that would be a violation of the statute? In other words, a coercive statement. The second part is, was it maintained? There are two allegations in the complaint, one that it was promulgated, and number two, that it was maintained. And it is very important to establish that it was not maintained. For one, it establishes, I think, evidence that the utterances were not even made as alleged, but also as to the issue of whether or not they were a basis for the strike, a reason for going on a strike a month later. In other words, for example, the statement by one employee that said, the foreman said that we were prohibited from going to the Chevron station, but hey, if you want to go, let's go. I mean, that's the exact testimony of the employees. And then they continue to go every day thereafter for an entire month. The fact that they continue to go for the entire month makes it very incredible to believe that a month later, they actually decided that they're going to go out and strike for that.
Wasn't there testimony, Mr. Pickens, when he appeared, he would tell them to get to work?
I'm sorry, what?
Was there not evidence that Superintendent Pickens, when he came to the Chevron station and saw them, told the employees to get back to work or get to work?
Okay. There was testimony like that. Now, that was in conjunction with allegations of surveillance, which were discredited by the judge. They credited the employer in that situation. Also, that testimony was inconsistent with the testimony of the other foreman, who...
That's not dependent on there being surveillance. Presence and surveillance were two different factual elements, weren't they? What was there not, as Judge Rogers suggested, evidence that when he was present, he told them to get back to work?
He allegedly told one foreman said that he said, get back to work. However, that foreman, when he was making that statement, was backtracking on his original testimony that said that he went to Foreman Ordonez, like the other five witnesses, initially said, I continued to go to the Chevron station every day. All of a sudden, when asked by the judge, even after you were told not to, that's when he started to backtrack. And that's when he said, well, I was, at one time I was told in front of the other foreman not to do that. Well, the other foreman never testified to that. Plus, he was then asked, well, the other foreman didn't raise this issue. Well, I got to the office early and I left early, so I never saw them. Well, that was totally inconsistent with all the other testimony of all other five witnesses, that they continued, both crews continued to go and meet with each other the entire month of September. So basically that testimony was being discredited. That person's testimony in that regard was not being credited by the judge. Okay? Or it certainly was totally inconsistent with all the other testimony. That's the importance of the fact that the five government witnesses, the four employees and the other foreman, all testified very specifically that they continued to go every single day all the way up to the strike. Okay. Now, and it was done in open, you know, observation of the management, including the foreman. So the allegation, the decision of the court, the judge and the board, that the rule was maintained was not supported by substantial evidence. I also submit that the statements themselves were not coercive in the context given. And here's the reason I'm saying that. For one, Damon Garcia said they were told that they are being prohibited from going to the Chevron as they were going to the Chevron, and they continue to go every day thereafter. Another employee says, well, we're being prohibited from going to the Chevron, but if you want to go, let's go. That's what the foreman was allegedly saying. That really, in that context, that really can't be considered to be a coercive statement or interfering with these rights of these employees. How can that be taken as really a threatening or an interference with their rights? Also, not only, if you take a close look at the facts, not only were they going to the Chevron as they were supposedly being told they were not going to the Chevron, they were also allegedly told at that same time, on August 24, that the company's changing its check cashing policy. We aren't going to get our checks anymore in the morning. It's going to be afternoon. But August 24, the date that they were going there, was a Friday. And they were, in fact, on their way to cash their checks. They, in fact, cashed their checks that way, according to the witnesses, the government witnesses. For example, Augustine Cuevas Ayala, Appendix 144, was asked, did you always cash your check at the Chevron station every Friday morning? The answer was yes. And Appendix 191, Alfonso R.C. Salazar was asked the same exact question, gave the same answer. Damian Garcia, Appendix 250, again, did you always cash your paycheck at the Chevron station every Friday morning? Answer is yes.
I want to make sure just how much you're disputing. If, in fact, the employer told the employees, you can't go to that Chevron and meet with the union representative, would you deny that that is an unfair labor practice, if that were established as the fact?
Yeah, I don't think that's a violation of the law. I don't think that's a violation of the law to tell your supervisors, don't go, take a different route to go to the, even if you have an intent not to.
If it has the intent and effect of interfering with the ability of employees to meet with a union representative, you would still say it's not an unfair labor practice?
Not when you're involving the foreman. The employer has, as the judge even noted, the employer has an obligation to make sure that the foreman, company officials, do not get intertwined with the organizing efforts. If you're telling your supervisor, and by the way, the board didn't cite any case for this. There's no case out there that supports the concept that an employer can't tell its foreman as they're going to work, hey, if you're going to work, go some other route. We aren't going
to
make it easy.
I don't understand that to be what the board is asserting. I understand the board to be saying you cannot use that to prevent employees from meeting with union representatives. I mean, there's a lot of access cases in other circumstances where the board has even held that an employer has to allow union representatives on the employer's premises. Now, that doesn't mean the board would say that the employer doesn't have the right to exclude people from the premises, but it would say that they can't exclude union representatives, qua union representatives, in the premises. Would this not be parallel to that, or have I lost you?
Well, the board and the courts basically say you don't have to allow union representatives on the company property.
Well, there are circumstances in which you do have to.
Only when there's no other means mm-hmm. available to enter the process.
Right.
So
right.
Basically the concept is you don't have to allow them, you don't have to make it easy for them.
No.
Okay. And
but if you let the Salvation Army have a booth on your parking lot, you can't keep the union from meeting with representatives.
Right, but that's a disparate enforcement of a lawful rule. The lawful rule is you can keep them out. And the lawful rule is the employer the employer doesn't have to assist in making it easy for a union to meet with employees. The employer here is only, at the worst case scenario, the employer is only saying, foreman, take a different route to go there. Now, there's also testimony by the union official, at Appendix 76, the union official also said, look, he had also had meetings, not only the Chevron, but he also met with them at union offices, and there's no allegation that the employer was saying, there was surveillance at the union offices, or they interfered with the employees, or anything like that. And one thing that was told at the TIPS meeting, the TIPS, by the way, are please do not threaten, interrogate, interfere with employees' rights, promise, or surveil them. Don't engage in this kind of thing. The employer on August 24 was educating its foreman and what it should not do with employees. And one of the foremen testified, and this was not even noted by the court, or the board, or the judge, or the board. One of the foremen acknowledged that he was told, hey, we the foremen, they didn't want us to meet with the union, but if the employees wanted to talk with the union, we were not to interfere. That testimony is from a government witness, and that was ignored by the judge and the board. I also note that another reason these statements were not coercive is because they were made by basically a pro-union supervisors that were sympathetic to the union and not the employer. They weren't acting on the employer's behalf. And I cited two cases in the board in my brief, the NLRB Albertsons and Paintfields case, where the union sympathizers, supervisor statements were not coercive, even though if they were in the normal course, if they were made by a pro-company supervisor, they would be coercive, but they were not coercive. And the board noted in those cases, in the Paintsville case, they noted the supervisors were treated as one of the employees treated the supervisors as one of their own in these concepts. And in that regard, union agent Bratcher at Appendix 92, stating in one of his meetings with the employees, I talked to the workers and the foreman. I saw them all as workers myself in this situation, even though the board said that, you know, one's a supervisor, one's an employee. I consider them to be all the same. And as a matter of fact, at the very early stages of the campaign, the foreman Salazar, in early 2007, when Bratcher's, the union official Bratcher, started to meet with the employees at the Chevron station, it was foreman Salazar that actually approached Bratcher with some complaints about his complaints about the employer working conditions. That's
I want to back you up just one moment.
Yeah.
On our question we were discussing before, do you make in your brief the argument that this rule is per se okay, that is to say that the employer could have said take a different route and it wouldn't be a violation?
Yes, I make that my brief that in effect it's an 8A2 violation to have the employer supervisors go in there and intermingle with them.
Okay, I'm not sure that I did have difficulty figuring out if you were arguing that the board is wrong, that this would be a ULP if the rule were promulgated, or if you were just saying that they didn't maintain it, therefore it's not a ULP because they didn't maintain it.
I did both arguments.
You did both?
Right. I did say that it's not against the law to tell your foreman, your supervisors, not to take the employees to meet with the union. And I noted that that would possibly be an 8A2 violation and pointed out where the judge also noted I think the judge's words, it was a dilemma for the employer. They have an obligation to keep the supervisors away from meeting with the union. Okay.
But didn't the ALJ here actually find that the superintendent's announcement of that policy discouraged the union activity?
All right. Now, that's something that allegedly happened on the 20th of September, the day of the strike. And that, I submit, is not supported by any direct testimony of a witness. A witness allegedly said that assistant supervisor, superintendent Loya made a statement they're going to delay the check cashing the next day, and also Matt Pickens supposedly said that. Then a follow-up question was, well, why did they say that? Why did the foreman tell you that they said that? And the foreman gave his, in effect, opinion, said, well, because they didn't want him to meet up with the union. But they didn't ask the question, and it was a hearsay question. They didn't ask the question, well, did the foreman tell you that Matt Pickens said such and such? That wasn't asked. And that was an issue that was not alleged in the complaint. All right. So that specific testimony was not in the complaint. All right. And it was also inconsistent with other testimony. Employee Rivera said the said that the company didn't tell them that they would start receiving their paychecks on Friday afternoon instead of Friday morning. And also, there's a misquote by the judge in footnote 12 of the decision, Appendix 545, where the judge tries to support the testimony of this one witness that that statement was made by saying that it was supported in part by a statement by Damon Garcia, but then she misquoted him. She simply said, quote, that Pickens was bent on the fact that we should not go to the gasoline station. But the full testimony is this. The question was by the government, what, if anything, did Matt Pickens say as to why he wasn't allowing you to go to Chevron to cash your checks? Answer, he didn't tell us anything. He was just bent on the fact we should not go to the gasoline station. So the judge left out the part about he didn't tell us anything, but just glommed on to the conclusionary statement, well, he was just bent on not going to having us go to the station. That's the kind of, and that footnote 12, I think, really shows the weakness of the judge's argument. The other witnesses didn't support this employee, and they misquoted one to get the support.
Is that a misquote or just a partial quote? A
partial quote, I'm sorry, and give it a misinterpretation based on the full quote.
We have run out of your time unless my colleagues have further questions. Seeing none, we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the governor.
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Devitt. I'm here, counsel for the National Labor Relations Board, and we're here seeking full enforcement of our order in this case. There is substantial evidence to support the board's finding that the company committed four unfair labor practices, three of which, in addition to some economic concerns of the employees, prompted an unfair labor practice strike in 2007. The first was the discriminatory and overbroad promulgation of and maintenance of a work rule that tended to chill employee Section 7 activity. The rule prohibiting employees from going to a Chevron station that they had gone to for years every morning for drinks and food and for discussion with their co-employees was halted abruptly only when the company found out that they were also meeting a union representative
I'm
there.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to take a brief recess. We will resume very shortly. Give us recess.
I'm going to just pick up where I left off, if that's okay.
Okay, that's fine.
It's settled that maintenance of a discriminatory work rule that has the tendency to chill section activity is a violation of the Act, and that's exactly what we have here. The change in the rule was in direct response to the employer finding out that employees were engaging in Section 7 activity at the Chevron, and the change inescapably interfered with the Section 7 activity because employees rode to the work site in their foreman's cars. So telling foremen not to drive to the Chevron inescapably interfered also with the employees' activities.
Suppose they had just said, we think you're wasting too much time. Gas up your vehicles before you pick up your crew and don't go back by filling stations on the way. Couldn't they have done that?
Right, that's the kind of non-discriminatory change in the rule for a legitimate business reason that's distinct from this case, and which wasn't alleged by the employer in this case. Instead, they said, don't go to the Chevron because we don't want employees talking to the union representative. Don't take them there to talk to him. So they could have promulgated it for a neutral business legitimate reason, but they didn't here. And that's what makes this a violation, because the employees would have been chilled in engaging in their section activity because they knew that that's why they were being told not to go there. The related paycheck delay violation is equally clear, telling employees that it's going to delay their paychecks to discourage them from going to the Chevron station, equally chilled their activities. And it's irrelevant in this case that those paychecks were never delayed and that they're that they continued to receive them on time. What was relevant was that they were told that they might interrupt this their paychecks for that reason. The final unfair labor practice underlying the strike in this case was the threat made to employees on September 20th of 2007 when the employer told them that if they went on strike, it would consider them to have quit. This is the very kind of language held in Accurate Wire, Conair, and other cases to be a threat of discharge in violation of the Act for engaging in protected activity. There is substantial evidence in the record to support the judge's finding that these three announcements by the company did underlie the decision to strike by the employees. The employees had complained to their supervisors about the rules. They'd complained to each other. They'd discussed striking and were still upset about all three of these issues on the day of the strike. Contemporaneous with the strike, going to tell the union representative that this was that these were the things that were upsetting them at the time. And whether or not the company thinks that they should have struck based on this, it doesn't matter. It's the employee's state of mind and their subjective reasons for striking that's at issue for the board. The fourth unfair labor practice didn't underlie this strike, but I believe it's equally well supported in this case. Union Representative Bratcher, upon appearing at the company's offices, was told that if he was told in response to his request for an application that if he didn't leave the property, he would be arrested. The company routinely handed out applications. The fact that it didn't hire directly from those applications is immaterial. The hostile treatment of him because of his union status is what's at issue here and would have the tendency
to
worsen.
Our timing is not accurately reflected by the time clock right now, so that sounds like a pretty good quitting place unless my colleagues have further questions. Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time.
We'll give the petitioner 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, going back to an earlier point you made, there is evidence and noted in the judge that on August 29th, Pickens appeared at the Chevron station and told former
Gore. Don't go by the light because it's set for 15 minutes at the moment. Okay. You get only two, so go ahead, please.
Okay, and told Guerrero that he needed to go to work. Nevertheless, in the context of that, there's no evidence that he was saying you're prohibited from coming to the Chevron at all. And with open knowledge by management, they continued to go to the Chevron. And that's very important because the statements themselves on the 24th of August, in the context that they were given, where they continued to go to the Chevron, as they were going to the Chevron, they're being told this, and as they were cashing checks, they were told, supposedly, that they weren't going to get checks. Just, it's not
that
enough a month
to
later.
The word maintain at most, doesn't it? You don't really seem to be disputing that they were told that.
There is evidence that it was said. I think it's ambiguous.
The motion you get out of that, it doesn't matter if it's ambiguous.
I understand.
We don't reweigh the evidence.
I understand.
The most you get out of that is that there might be a misuse of the word maintain in the decision. Other than that, why isn't that supportive of exactly what the board found?
Well, as far as the statement itself, I can understand a decision that if the court agrees that that would be a violation, that would be a violation of an utterance on the 24th of August. But that still does not support that a decision a month later that the employees would go out on strike over that utterance when they, in fact, were not ever denied the opportunity to go to the Chevron or they never were stopped getting their checks. A couple of other issues I'd just like to quickly point out. One, and the judge did not address this, the day before and the morning of the strike, a foreman called the union and said, that they're going to go out and strike. On the morning, they said, the guys are not going to go to work. He said specifically that they were going to talk to Matt Pickens, confront him about their working conditions. So the only issue being relayed by a management person to the union was they're going to talk about working conditions. Right after they got to the Chevron, the Roberto Arce called and said the workers were on strike and they're at the Chevron. Then the Bratcher met with them and said, we can convert this to an unfair labor practice. And you don't convert something to an unfair labor practice. The decision to go out on strike over economic considerations had already been made, and that was not addressed by the board.
If it's working conditions, then it is an unfair labor practice.
What's that?
If it's a working conditions, then it is a ULP strike, isn't it?
No, if it's over working conditions, then it's an economic strike.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Right.
Your time's
up. Right.
Case is submitted.
Thank you.